Recording. Hi, my name is Adriana Sisco. I'm interviewing Julie Smoke for The Country Remembering Lexington's First Lesbian Bar. The date is September 17th, 2020, and we are doing this interview over Zoom. Julie is over in Georgetown at her place of work in her car, and I am in my home in Lexington. Julie, thank you for talking with me today, by the way.
Sure.
No problem. And to start us off, how about you tell me a little bit about yourself, just the basics?
Okay, born actually in Georgia, moved to Lexington when my dad got on with IBM years and years ago. Spent most of my life growing up in Lexington with a brief 5-year stint in Northwest Florida. But basically Lexington's been my home as long as I can remember. And currently I work for one of the Toyota Group companies. I'm environmental manager for the corporation.
Okay, awesome. You mentioned that there was a 5-year stint in Florida. Was that just like the first 5 years or so of your life, or?
No. My parents divorced about the time I was turning 12, and my mom moved us from Lexington to Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And so I was down there through my junior year of high school, right before I turned 16, my mom decided to move to England. I had no interest in coming back to Kentucky because I had my first girlfriend at the time, and I wound up moving in with her and her family at 15 and getting my own child support check and paying them room and board, which was quite the interesting experience. Really long story, but my dad found out about a year later, confronted me on my 17th birthday, and next thing I knew, I was moved up to Lexington. So that's how I got back up to Kentucky.
Gotcha. So it sounds like there was some moving around, but most of your time was spent in Lexington, whether it was like the earlier portion or the latter portion.
Yeah.
Tell me about the earlier portion of just being a young, like being a kid in Lexington. Just tell me what were your experiences like? What was that like? What kind of?
Well, it's very different from being a kid today. Cause I mean, we, you know, if we weren't in school, as long as the weather was decent, we'd be down the creek or riding our bikes down to Garden Side Shopping Center or Turfa Mall when it finally opened up. And mothers would just yell out the door for people to come home. And sometimes there'd be like a relay kind of thing that, you know, Julie, your mom's calling you because Susan's mom heard my mom or whatever. So it wasn't quite the helicopter parenting that we have now or the paranoia. I think some of that obviously is well-founded. But it seemed just a safer time, easier time to be a kid, I think.
It sounds like everyone kind of knew each other in the neighborhood. And did you?
We walked to school. I mean, it amazes me that kids are not allowed to walk to school anymore. That's just amazing. I didn't walk that far. You know, it wasn't 3 miles both ways uphill in the snow or anything. But it was a pretty good, probably. Well, Juniper Drive to Garden Springs Elementary, probably about 3/4 of a mile, something like that.
You mentioned Garden Springs Elementary. Tell me about that school in general, your experience there, what it was like at the time.
It was a fairly new school. It was one of the first schools in Fayette County that got central air conditioning. I remember that. That happened when I was like in 4th or 5th grade. My dad was one of the prime people on that project to get it funded and get it put in and all. It was a very white school until 6th grade when they actually did do a little bit of busing in Fayette County. We had our first 2 black kids and I was all excited, but some of my racist relatives were not happy, not my immediate family, but like my mom's parents or that side of the family was pretty racist. And so, you know, I didn't understand why I shouldn't want to have black kids in my school. I was really excited about it. And then, you know, these 2 little kids show up and they're just as kind and sweet and quiet. And then I was like, I don't get the big deal. So, you know, some early learning about prejudice and racism and segregation and just what reality was. You know, my experience was these kids were like any other kids, you know, and we didn't really have the same interests, so we didn't interact that much. But if we had both been interested in athletics or science or whatever, maybe we would have been great friends, you know. But it wasn't like things have been portrayed to me to be that, you know, the kids were going to come in and ruin the school kind of thing.
Uh-huh. So it sounded like the adults around, some of the adults around you were somewhat hysterical about it, whereas from your perspective, yes, you were kind of like, what's the big deal, basically? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a great neighborhood to grow up in. Lots of playground availability, and like I said, we had a creek down at the end of my street, and you know, so you go find crawfish and stuff like that. So it was very good growing up time. Yeah.
And in general, was religion a part of your household, and to what degree? Like, did anyone have any kind of faith or go to church or anything like that?
Yeah, my mom's side of the family was kind of split between Pentecostal Holiness Assembly of God. Her dad was Baptist. Her mom was Southern Methodist. My dad's side of the family was Southern Methodist. And so we wound up going to Methodist Church, actually at Southern Hills there on Harrodsburg Road, was where I went most of the time growing up. And we weren't, you know, we weren't like crazy religious. We didn't go every single Sunday, but, you know, enough of the values being reinforced at home, not necessarily couched under Jesus or God or whatever, but just, you know, how to be a decent human being.
And you mentioned, you know, playing with kids in your neighborhood and stuff. Who were your friends when you were that age? Was it school friends, neighborhood friends, or were those two groups kind of the same group?
They're the same group. Yeah. And, you know, mostly I played with kids within like three blocks of my house. That was kind of typical. You had little pockets of kids that played together, and sometimes you'd overlap to get up enough for a football game or a baseball game or whatever. But basically it was kids in my class and in my neighborhood.
Gotcha. And then we have this coming up on this like big transition period over into Florida. Tell me about the area that you lived in there, maybe the school there, your perception of what it was like. Was it very different from Lexington? Was it similar?
Yeah, so in Fort Walton Beach, I live like, I think it was like 3.5 miles from my school. So all of a sudden I was riding the bus for the first time ever, had to ride across two bridges to get there. My mom, you know, now a single parent, she kind of went crazy on us. She married like right out of high school and then had two kids back to back. So once she was free, she kind of forgot she had two kids. So she'd be working second or third shift, and it'd be our responsibility, you know, in seventh grade for me to get myself up in time and make it to the bus. And sometimes I'd miss the bus. So, you know, sometimes I didn't have a bike. I'd have to walk that whole way to get to school. So things radically changed when we moved down to Florida. And it wasn't the same neighborhood feel. I mean, I was a new kid on the block, literally, to begin with. I didn't know anybody down there. But because you know, I'm academically pretty solid and also was a good athlete, I made friends pretty quickly through my sports teams and just academia, kids wanting help with work or whatever. You know, the core person that I was didn't change at all. I mean, I've been very blessed to have a clarity about who I am and how other people's opinions of me can or cannot affect me and who I am. You know, I see bullshit pretty quickly coming. And I think my dad in particular kind of instilled that in us that, you know, if he thought we were playing dumb or not trying hard enough, he would let us know. You're smarter than that. Don't lie to me. This is my expectation. You know, so he set the bar pretty high for us to be the best people that we could be and to not yield to outside pressures or other, like I said, other people's opinions of us. And that really has served me very well in my life for sure. I mean, between being a lesbian and then, you know, the way I present, I've never been feminine at all. When I was a kid, up until I quit smoking many years ago, I was very thin on top of it. So white skinned, thin, masculine. So I got a lot of teasing and picking on, but it never really affected me that much, because those were just surface things. And again, I had a core instilled in me early enough on to know that I didn't care what they thought about me. So,
yeah. I have two follow-up questions to that. One, you mentioned sports. What sports were you doing at that age?
Pretty much everything. I hated track. I did basketball, track, volleyball, and softball, because those were pretty much the sports that were played in team, competition between schools. I hated track. I thought it was stupid to be running, and there's not a ball, and you're not scoring points. If you're going to be running, there should be points in a ball, I hated volleyball because it hurt. I mean, I'm tall and thin, gangly, and so everybody wanted me to play volleyball, so I said, okay, but it hurt. So I stopped after one season. I only did one season of track. And then so basketball and softball were my two big sports.
And then my second question is, you mentioned that it didn't really bother you and you didn't really let it bother you that people maybe would make teasing remarks about your appearance. But I am curious about, the culture that was sort of surrounding you. So, what was it that prompted these comments? Was it, your clothing or just your actual physical appearance? Was it hair? What was it that they were...
I had braces for a really long time. So through most of junior high, what we called it back then, for most of junior high, I had braces. And so, I was Bucktooth Joe and I was skinny white girl because I was living down at the beach, right? And so chicken legs and pasty white brace face and all that stuff. So unfortunately I never had acne. That was so I never returned any of that stuff. I had thoughts like the kids that were all broken out. I was like, yeah, you're calling me skinny. What all names could I call you? with your big pockmarked face.
And you mentioned also never having been, at least your description, never having been very feminine. I think you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. How was it that you sort of expressed that? Was it more of an attitude, or was it more you didn't like to wear, say, dresses?
It wasn't conscious. It wasn't conscious. I mean, I've got a picture I can send you if you're interested. I call it my prophecy picture of me when I was 4 years old. My sister was six, and it's taken at Christmas time. And back then, Sears put out the Wish Book, which was their Christmas catalog, the Wish Book, what kids would want to get for Christmas, all the toys and musical instruments and all that stuff. And so I was really into horses my entire life. My grandfather on my dad's side loved horses, and we were living here, and he was in South Carolina, but we were here in horse country on top of it. And so I wanted a cowboy outfit. Well, in the Sears catalog, they had the cowgirl outfit, which, I can't remember if one or both of my parents said, oh, don't you want a cowgirl outfit? Look, here's a cowgirl outfit. But I noticed quickly that the cowgirl outfit came with a skirt and did not come with a gun. And so I was like, that's just stupid. I want the cowboy outfit and a set of drums. And so this picture is me and my sister. She's wearing the cowgirl outfit, which of course was white, and I'm wearing the cowboy outfit at four, which is black, and I've got the hat on and the gun, and I'm waving my drumstick because my drum set's right in front of me too. So you tell me, I'm 4 years old. And I mean, I've never been confused about gender. I don't want to be called bae or whatever. I'm happy being a woman. I'm glad I don't have my period anymore. That's for damn sure. But I've never wanted to be a guy or felt like I wasn't a woman. So it's not about that. It's more about just my own gender expression, I guess. Not wanting to be stereotyped. I never liked dresses. I could rock a dress. And the times that I did wear dresses, people were like, dang, you look good. Or a suit with a skirt or whatever. But I just never was comfortable. I mean, my preferred outfits were suitable should a basketball game break out. I can play, I'm not going to be on the sidelines going, oh, I'm wearing a skirt, I can't play, or I've got high heels on or whatever. So, I mean, I really would describe that back then that, I want to be prepared in case a game breaks out.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. Okay, I'm going to start shifting topics a little bit.
Okay.
So we're going to start getting more into the, like, sexuality and lesbian direction, because obviously that's a part of this interview. Did you have any awareness growing up of lesbians or other gay people or just people who are different in general existing, whether it's like things you heard about, people you met, things you saw on TV? Like, did you ever encounter anything where you're like, huh, you know, what is that? What's going on there?
Yeah. My earliest remembrance of any sort of same-sex attraction, we were actually living in Atlanta before we moved to Kentucky. So I was like 3, I think. And there was a babysitter that I just loved. I mean, I wanted her to come live with us. And then same thing when I was in, I think, third grade. My teacher was Mrs. Banks. And third grade was about the time that we started having slumber parties. And I remember laying in my bed one night and thinking, wouldn't it be cool if I had a slumber party and Mrs. Banks came? And then that extended to, wouldn't it be cool if I had a slumber party and Mrs. Banks was the only one who came? So then when we moved to Florida, there were two women that lived basically directly across the street from us, two adult women. And my mom had made the remark that they were lesbians. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't really care. But then I got on the softball team, and I was telling my maternal grandmother that I had gotten on the softball team, and she said, oh, don't play softball. I was like, why not? Because I was really excited, you know? She's like, no, there's lesbians. And I was like, what? And she kept saying lesbians. And the way she was saying, I couldn't even look it up in the dictionary because I couldn't figure out how to spell it. It was when my mom talked about the ladies across the street saying they were lesbians that I finally had a clue that maybe, you know, I could actually look this word up. And I did. I had this little paperback dictionary. And this was another kind of blessing in my life. The definition for lesbians in that Merriam-Webster dictionary from years ago, decades ago, probably published in like 1970 or something, because this would have been 73, I think, 73, 74. It said a woman who loves other women. And I was like, instantly, that's me. And then my second thought was, and they're full of shit, meaning like my grandmother and all the other people who talked about homosexuals. That was another thing, lesbians and homosexuals. I was thinking of Medusa with snakes coming out of her head or something. And I was like, no, that's me, and they're full of shit. And so I never had any moment angst over my identity and who I was. And that, I count that, because I have so many friends who went through hell and, you know, compromised their own psyche, basically, because of what other people were telling them their reality should be. So I feel very, very blessed that I never went down that road.
How old were you again when you had this, like, dictionary kind of moment, like ballpark?
12.
12, okay, got it. And
12, going on 13, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, yeah, these neighbors, obviously this teacher that you wish she was, like, at the sleepover. Do you remember noticing any kids your age, like at school or something, that seemed, you know, had that kind of vibe?
It wasn't until I was in high school that there was any like widespread discussion of anything like that. I had my first girlfriend. I was in 9th grade and she was in 8th grade, I think. That was the first girlfriend I had that I kissed. And then once I got in, cause junior high then was 7th, 8th, 9th. And once I got into 10th grade was when I had my first sexual girlfriend. And then there was no stopping me after that. I mean, I don't even want to tell you, there was a gaggle of us, even though it's little tiny Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Let's see. I mean, at least 8 people I can think of just off the top of my head in 10th grade. So that was kind of the, you know, unveiling. And when I talk to my straight friends about that, they're like, wow, you were young. And I'm like, I was with my peers. You know, about the time they're starting to fool around, I'm starting to fool around. It was very age appropriate. You know, just because it was same sex doesn't mean it wasn't any less age appropriate in my book. Because it wasn't like I was, you know, going out with 25-year-old women or something. These were other 15, 16-year-old girls.
And when it came to sort of like these early relationships that you had, did you all use the word lesbian, or is that not really part of the vocabulary? Was it just like, this is what we do, this is how we feel, or did any kind of like terminology come about?
It's all about who you were seeing. That's what we say, who you're seeing. We didn't really like the word lesbian. That word kind of got reclaimed, probably in the 80s, 90s, something like that, was when the queer movement, you know, gay and lesbian kind of became, and I still have friends who don't like the word lesbian. We would say girlfriend, but, you know, you had to be discreet, right? So there wasn't a lot of overt talking about it at all. I mean, even me and my girlfriends, now we would write notes and we'd write, I love you, and, you know, some racy kind of stuff from time to time, but there wasn't really terminology being used.
And you mentioned that because of just the culture at the time, that there weren't that many sort of out loud, outspoken conversations about this kind of thing. So I was kind of curious to know who all like knew about these relationships, because I can't imagine it was like being broadcast to the universe. But I wanted to ask you, was it like, did any of your friends know about your girlfriends? Did family, or did they not know? Like who knew and who didn't know at the time?
Family was a big no, because, you know, you get disowned, big time trouble, not be able to play sports or leave your house or whatever. So nobody that I knew was out to their family at all. And it was, you know, it was kind of easy for us to hide because we were girls and we were allowed to have sleepovers, you know, and so there you go. And then a lot of parents worked and, you know, we'd get home from school early. When I was in 10th grade, when I was a junior, 11th grade, I regularly snuck out my window at night and went to my girlfriend's house and spent the night with her there. You know, we got almost busted a couple of times, but I'd get up early enough to sneak back to my house and get dressed for school. So that's just pretty much how it went. And, you know, there'd be accusations from time to time, like, you're a dyke or you're queer, you know, and you'd always just deny it.
Who were the accusations from? Was it like your peers or was it adults or what?
No, peers, just typical kids picking on each other kind of stuff.
And this eight or so group of people that you mentioned, of these girls that were sort of in this like, I don't know, network almost, did any of them ever get caught? Or get in the kind of trouble that you mentioned? Because you kind of mentioned this idea of, oh, you know, you get in really big trouble if you were to get caught. So I was curious if anyone ever did.
No, not that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it's easier for girls to kind of hide too. Like gay boys, you know, they're a little more out there, whatever. I did when I was a senior in high school. My girlfriend's at the time, her parents said we couldn't be friends anymore. I think they kind of had an inkling. I was a couple of years older than her for one thing, and I think they kind of figured out that something was going on, and so they said we could not be friends any longer, which broke my heart, of course. But I'm still in touch with that girl to this day. I mean, I've got a few people like that that are still in my life, which is really kind of cool.
How old were you when that happened, when they mentioned, when the parents were like, oh, you guys can't talk anymore?
I was a senior and she was in 9th grade, so she was quite a bit younger than me. But the way we met was she went to Morton, and I was at Henry Clay because I was back in Kentucky by this time. Went to 3 different high schools in 2 different states, which really sucked, especially my senior year. But So I had a vehicle. Morton didn't have a softball team. So because of Title IX, they had a baseball team. So because of Title IX, their kids were allowed to try out for Henry Clay's softball team. And there were two that made it. And one of them was the girl that I wound up being girlfriends with for a time. So I would pick them up from Morton and take them to practice or to games or whatever. So it didn't hurt that I had a van at the time too. So
yeah, it helps. tell me about the, you mentioned.
My dad bought me that van after moving me to Kentucky for being gay. He buys me a van. What does he think's going to happen?
Yeah, the van. Come on. Actually, tell me about that transition from Florida, and then you come back to Lexington, and you explained a little, you gave me sort of the overview at the beginning of the interview, but I want sort of the full story of, like, what happened, and you mentioned your dad just now.
Oh, God, how long do you have?
It depends on how much time you have, really.
So, my first love was a girl named Tina. We were both juniors down in Fort Walton Beach High School in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And in the summertime, I would make the route from relative to relative, right? And so I have relatives in Georgia, Columbus and Atlanta, and then South Carolina, and then my dad was in Lexington. So I just make this big round trip and come back home. So my first stop was in Atlanta at my mom's parents' house, and I hated being away from Tina. I just knew that she and Rhonda were going to start fooling around, because I knew Rhonda had eyes for her. So, you know, I was just all paranoid. You better write me every day and all this stuff. And so I had told my grandmother to watch for letters. You know, I'm expecting letters from my friend. I might get some letters. And so I never got any letters. So the time came for me to move on to South Carolina. And that was my dad's hometown, tiny little town. And there was a payphone down by the railroad tracks, down uptown, as they say, in this tiny little town. And so I gathered every bit of change that I could dig up, and I went down there and I called Tina. And I said, why haven't you written me any letters? And I'm having to put in quarters, you know, to keep the time going. And she swore up and down that she had written me letters. And I'm like, well, maybe, you know, they're just getting to my grandmother in Atlanta's place, and she'll forward them on to me here because I'm going to be here for a month, whatever. Well, little did I know, my grandmother in Atlanta had been intercepting the letters and reading them. And Tina, she would write me notes. If we didn't have a class together, I would get a note from her with some pretty racy stuff about, you know, get your skinny little buns back in my arms where they belong. I can't wait to make love to you tonight, blah, blah, blah. So I'm just thinking, well, at this time, I don't know where the letters are. So my dad comes to South Carolina. He's going to spend a few days at his mom's house and all of us together before we come back to Kentucky. And this is over my birthday. So my 17th birthday, he and I drive up to Columbia to have dinner. And we're driving back, and he says, Julie, I got a question for you. I said, what's that, Dad? He said, what would give the relatives in Atlanta the idea that you're having a love affair with a woman in Florida? And I was like, and I said, well, I don't know. And I'm glad that we're driving, because I'm sitting in the passenger seat just like going, holy shit, scared to death. And I blubbered out something about how we joke, you know, we joke about going steady, which we did. We would joke about going steady. And, you know, we take the bread ties and we make little rings like we're going steady. It's just a big joke. And he says, oh, okay. And so I thought we were done. I can tell you the exact spot on the highway between Columbia, South Carolina and North Comma, South Carolina, where this took place. If I go down there, I'm like, oh my God, this is where it took place. So a couple weeks go by, we're in Kentucky. I've still never gotten any letters from Tina. And so I'm thinking, I've just convinced she and Rhonda are messing around and it's over and I can't wait to get back and just yell at her or whatever. So I'd gone somewhere in Lexington, I think to Lexington Mall or something. And I come back home, my dad's there, and he says, Julie, get in here. I said, yes, sir. And he says, I'm going to ask you one more time, and don't you lie to me. What would give the relatives in Atlanta the idea that you're having a lesbian love affair with a woman in Florida? And I started to say, don't you lie to me. I was like, oh my God, I had no idea what was going on. But I was in school in Lexington before I went back home to pack my shit in Fort Walton Beach. So, you know, abruptly jerked up to Kentucky. Come to find out that my maternal grandmother had intercepted the letters and read them. Her daughter, my mom, had moved to England, so obviously not in a position to do anything. My dad is her former son-in-law, so they don't really talk. So this woman actually called my dad anonymously with these allegations. Your daughter's having a lesbian affair in Florida. And my dad knew who it was because she had a really distinctive voice, but she didn't identify herself. So apparently, after no shit hit any fan, my grandmother decided it was time to actually identify herself and give him the evidence. And so I cannot tell you what the evidence was because to this day, I've never seen those letters. I have no idea if they're still in existence anywhere or whatever. And Tina would not tell me. She never would tell me what was in those letters. So they must have been pretty bad. So that's how I wound up back in Kentucky. And that was for my senior year. I had gone my sophomore year to Choctahatchee High School in Fort Walton Beach. We had a house fire, had to move, put me in Fort Walton Beach's district. And then Henry Clay. So three different high schools and two different states sucked. I mean, once again, I was a new kid on the block. But it didn't take very long to meet other people. And my senior year is when I discovered the country. So that kind of brings us to the actual purpose of this interview.
That was a great story, by the way. So you get back to Lexington, you're a senior, so are you like 17, 18 by this point?
Yeah, 17. I have an August birthday, so I just turned 17.
Uh-huh. And was it as you were finishing high school that you stumbled across the country, or was it once you graduated?
No, it was fall of 1978, which was my fall of my senior year, so I was barely 17. And somehow I had already hooked up with a girlfriend. I mean, I don't know how your life plays out, but there's Gaydar and there's, you know, and you figure things out and then you have little side conversations and next thing you know, you're hooked up or whatever.
And oh, so, yeah, I get it. I'm gay, so.
So my girlfriend and I, we had stopped at a convenience store that used to be just off Southland Drive. I think it's a skate shop now or something. And so we had noticed a woman with a little mini truck, which was like the first little getting gas. And she was pretty butch. She was older than us, but she had short hair and jeans and a man-tailored shirt and driving a pickup truck. And we wound up striking up a conversation with her, you know, just kind of like, you know, giving the, we are, you are too, right, you know. And one of us said, what are you up to tonight? And somebody said nothing. And then this woman said, well, I'm going to this really cool bar, women's bar, that's about to open up. And we're like, oh, yeah? And she said, yeah. And we're like, well, where's that at? And she said, well, follow me. So it wasn't even open yet. And she apparently was helping do carpentry work or paint or something. I don't remember what her role was. But so, yeah, at 17, found the lesbian bar of the country before it even opened. And then after that, I mean, I was there just about every night that it was open. I mean, I think they were closed Sunday and Monday. So Tuesday through Saturday, just about, not all through high school, but after I graduated from high school and moved out. Pretty much every night. So
yeah, so you said Tuesday to Saturday is when they were open usually, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were closed Sunday and Monday. That's kind of common for a lot of bars, you know, that it's a owner-operator kind of deal. They want to have Sunday, Monday off, 2 days off in a row without killing their business.
Do you remember your first night there, first evening or night there? Or at least just, like, the feeling of it.
No, I mean, the first time I went, like I said, they were still, like, building the bar and tearing stuff out and putting stuff in. And I remember that. But as far as, like, I remember many a time sweating, paying cover to get in that I was going to get carded. But as tall as I was, and I was pretty mature for my age, and, I mean, I've been buying cigarettes and beer for 2 or 3 years at that point. So longer than that, actually. I think I started smoking when I was 13. And I just, I don't know, I just knew how to present myself to, you know, to not get carded. But the funny thing was, there was a woman named Peggy Willoughby who was one of the main bartenders for a long time. One night I went in, I think I was 20, and she said, "Smoke, you got your ID on you?" And I said, "Yeah, but it doesn't say I'm 21. And she said, "What?" I said, "Yeah, I'm not 21. And she said, "Girl, you've been coming in here for years. Ain't you 21 yet?" And she wound up actually giving me her daughter's fake ID, because her daughter had aged out of needing a fake ID. So I had her daughter's fake ID for a time that looked nothing like me, but I normally didn't have to present it.
When you saw the country in its very early stages, like, still being built, was it women building it, or was it?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I was going to ask if it was all women building it even.
Yeah.
Tell me about sort of you described, like, physically, like, where it was, and that, you know, they're building it and the days that it's open. Do you remember the businesses next door to the country, or were there ones directly next door? Just tell me about sort of like the surrounding area. Was it loud? Yeah, quiet? Was it safe, unsafe? You know, that kind of
stuff. Yeah. As you know, it's in a little bitty strip center on Lane Allen Road. I did notice the other day, Pamela D. Wiggs is still there. The very far right end of the thing as you're facing it. I don't remember what the other businesses were. They were office type things, like 9 to 5. I think there's always been an insurance office, like, right sharing that same foyer, because in the middle of that strip center, you actually would go in a foyer, and there were some steps going down. There was an office, and then back this way to the left back corner was where the country was. Because of the nature of those businesses and the location, you know, it was kind of behind Turflin Mall and another strip center. But again, those businesses were pretty much closed by, you know, 7, 8 o'clock, if not earlier. I did feel very safe because there was no signage. There was no signage. I think on the inside door, I think they had stenciled the country, but there was nothing on the outside of the place to even tell you there was a bar there. So that meant we were left alone for the most part, but there were times when, you know, it was a very small place, and it would get packed. I mean, packed. And you get so hot, you need to go out and get a breath of fresh air or go outside to smoke or whatever. And there'd be somebody had figured out that there were lesbos in this little bar, and so a carload of rednecks would come flying through the parking lot, yelling out, "Dyke, bitch, lesbo," you know, but usually there were more of us than them. And usually there were several of us who were much tougher than them, you know, some big burly bull dyke kind of looking women that they didn't stop to mess with us. So that didn't happen very often.
So it just...
One very interesting thing though was since it was the only place in town exclusively for women, and it's a pretty small community. Remember the two girls from Morton Middle School that I picked up for softball? Well, the PE teacher at Morton at that time, I won't say her name for her privacy or whatever, but she had a very distinctive car, and she had El Camino, which is like a little car that looks like a pickup truck. And I remember the night that I saw her car in the parking lot at the country. And I was like, and so then I walk in and she knows me as the high school kid that's coming to pick up the softball players, but she's a teacher. And now she's even more, you know, if you're a teacher and you're gay, you're gone. You're gone back then. No questions asked. And I felt really, I felt it extremely important for me to communicate to her non-verbally, I'm not saying anything to anybody about seeing you out here. And those two girls actually asked me, because they knew about the country, but they were so young, they didn't have a car, and so they couldn't, like, leave their house and go scope it out or whatever. And they asked me if I ever saw Miss So-and-so at the country. And I'd say, you're going to have to ask her about that. You know, and then years later, we did kind of run in the same circles, ultimately. And I did let her know about that. I was like, you know, I hope you felt it, that, you know, as soon as I saw you, I was trying to project to you, your secret's safe with me. I'm not telling anybody. You know, and I did tell her that they asked, and I specifically said, you're going to have to ask her about that. It was a really weird position to be in at 17.
Yeah, had she received kind of your eye message that you weren't gonna, you know, do anything?
Well, she was shooting daggers at me, like, you better damn well not say a word about seeing me here. And I was looking back at her like, I ain't saying nothing. Because she is a pretty tough chick. I mean, she was fairly feminine and smaller than me, except not as tall, but maybe a bit heavier built. But not, you know, I mean, she wasn't like some burly gym teacher looking woman. She was a math teacher who happened to also be the gym teacher. So, you know, it wasn't like I felt intimidated by her into that. It was more I felt like a moral obligation to recognize the jeopardy that it would put her in if word got out.
Right. Did that end up ever happening to anyone who went to the country? Like, word sort of getting out about them going there? Or did you never hear about a story like that? Or were people able to keep, you know, the knowledge kind of very internal, or what?
Not that I remember. Mm-hmm. Now, the school system's one thing, but other businesses or employers might be different. I mean, I've always said Lexington is a strangely tolerant town. You know, we're Southern, but not. We're Midwestern, but not. You know, we have all this horse money, but it's horse money, you know, agricultural-based shit on your boots money. You know, so there's a down to earthness but an eliteness at the same time that's really kind of weird. And it's been like during those years, like late 70s, 80s, 90s, it was like, I'm not bothering you, you don't bother me, and we're all fine. You know, as long as it wasn't too much in anybody's face or anything like that, it was just not that big a deal.
Gotcha. And I had a couple of follow-up questions. So you mentioned that, like, at the country, there wasn't an external sign, and you kind of remembered on the inside of the door, maybe they had etched the country. Were there no windows either? Like, could you not see inside from the outside?
Nope.
No windows, which makes sense considering. Yeah. And you mentioned that, you know, sometimes there are these people that would drive by and shout things, but, you know, there were more of you than there were of them, so generally it didn't, like, escalate beyond that point. Was there ever any police presence?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard about this. So,
so yeah, there were, I would say many times, not just a few, but many times that I was there that the cops would come in and make them turn the lights on, the music off, line everybody up against the walls, and check IDs. And like I've said, I mean, I wasn't legally there for very long at all. And so the routine was, if I didn't see the cops coming in, everybody knew who was underage, right? And so somebody would let me know, cops. And I would go hide in the bathroom until they were gone. Somebody come get me and say, okay, they're gone now. But this one night, I was shooting pool. I was a pretty good pool player. And I had my back to the door watching my opponent, and a friend of mine walked up to me and said, "Smoke, cop." And I said, "Thank you." And I handed her my stick, and I went to the bathroom. And I waited and waited and waited and waited and wished I'd brought my cigarettes and wished I'd brought my beer because I was waiting so long. And then finally somebody came and got me and said it was okay. And I was like, "Gee, I mean, Christmas, what is it?" So, well, they wouldn't leave. They just stayed here forever. And so I walked back out, and they're playing pool. And I'm like, "Hey, it was my table. What are y'all doing?" And they're like, "Nope, it's not your table anymore." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And so apparently one of the cops had stood there watching this idle pool table, and he finally said, "Whose shot is it?" And someone said, "Smokes." And he's like, "Well, where is she?" And they're like, "We don't know." And he said, "Okay, well, then I'll take her shot." And he wound up losing my game. So pissed. But yeah, that actually would happen. And it was intimidating. It wasn't like terrifying, but it was clear that it was intended to harass and intimidate. And it sucked.
So it happens not infrequently.
You know, I couldn't tell you exactly how many times, but I'd say at least 4 or 5 times when I was there. It happened enough that it's vivid memories to me. And I think some of the other people you might talk to that were actually, like, more involved. In fact, I've got you hooked up with one of the original owners to talk to her. Might have a little better remembrance of that.
Okay. Yeah. I got so many names from you. I was looking at them today, actually. Thank you. Okay. Follow-up questions again. So you mentioned pool a couple times. What were sort of the activities people did at the country? So there's the pool table. What did people do when they were there?
Okay, so I made that little mock-up floor plan deal for you. It was kind of a weird, it's like almost like a separate little foyer here, and then you kind of made a U-turn to get into the main part of the bar, and then the dance floor was over here. So you paid cover. That first door brought you kind of to the side, and then you made a U-turn to go into the bar itself. In that room, there was a pool table, a foosball table, and then the bar, and then the bathrooms were back here. And it was not that big of a space. I mean, if you had 20 people in there, it was pretty crowded. And there were most Saturday nights many, many more people than that. So people would play pool, people play foosball. The dance floor, they finally built like a little bench going around a horseshoe around the dance floor. So you actually had a place to sit, but I don't think they ever had tables in there because it was just too small. I mean, you put tables in and you don't have a dance floor anymore. There was a door off of the dance floor out the back. It wasn't really like a balcony. It was more like a service, like, steps going down to the parking lot, because it's kind of built into a hillside, right? So you, out the back door, you're actually up, and there was kind of like a balcony and then some steps, and people would maybe go out there and smoke from time to time, but most of the time you're either inside or out in the front parking lot milling about.
What kind of music did they play?
Oh, disco.
Disco?
Disco and R&B, you know, Kool and the Gang and Donna Summer and just dance music. One of my friends, I think you're going to talk to Louise Atwood, she was a DJ for the longest time, and she was really
disco club scene. So she played the Studio 54 albums and the 12-inch disco versions of songs, and she played stuff that never got played on the radio in Lexington.
Uh-huh. Say that one more time, because there was some beeping that happened.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're totally fine. what was it again?
Where did I cut out?
Not that long ago, you mentioned Louise Atwood, friend, was the DJ, and then you started talking about the kind of music she'd play, I think, and then that was it.
Yeah, she was really plugged into the New York disco scene, which is, you know, that is the height. You're talking 78, 79, 80. That was the height of the big city disco scene. And so she would play Studio 54, had like a double album, I think, that came out. that was the big disco bar in New York City. They actually had a double album that came out of dance music. And she played stuff that you'd never heard on the radio in Lexington, Kentucky. Never. She played, like, One Night in Bangkok, which was a song from a Broadway show called Chess. I don't know if you've ever heard the song. It's a great song.
That's the one I haven't heard of. The
set
other
to Esmeralda Moment.
Yeah. Was there ever
any... Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, set to Esmeralda?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. That was another one she liked to play, so. And then she would also wear our butts out. Laura Jones, who you're going to talk to, too, she and I like to dance together. Louise would intentionally play back-to-back. Oh, shoot. One of the songs was Turning Japanese. Oh, I can't believe I'm blanking on the first song that she would play, which was Whip It, Devo Whip It. She played Whip It, followed by Turning Japanese. And, I mean, the dance floor was clear. Laura and I would just be going crazy and then not able to move for about 3 hours after that. So.
Did the country ever have live music, or was it just sort of like records or whatever that was played there?
Very occasionally there would be some live music. I don't know who really spearheaded that. That was before I got into concert production. But I remember there were two women, Sandy and Shirley, that both played acoustic guitars. They were really good. They played from time to time. It was mostly local people. But Sandy and Shirley are the only ones I definitely remember for sure playing there.
And what was sort of the bar clientele like? I'm imagining this is all women, but tell me if there were ever exceptions. Was it all women that were there and worked there, or was there variation?
So it was pretty much all women because, not because the owners didn't want men there, but there was the bar, you know, the Johnny Angel, I think it was still called Johnny Angel at that point. So the men had their two-story palace and their showroom and all that stuff. Well, they want to go to, you know, where all the fish are, as they would say. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but
yeah.
Oh, fish. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the teacher, getting back to the teacher I was talking about earlier, her brother is actually gay too. And so occasionally Jack was his name. Jack would come out to the country because he hung out with their softball team. And I think he kept the scorebook or something. So Jack was one of the guys that would come in. There was another fella, Gene, that Louise is really good friends with. And I think those guys just kind of like to change of pace. Just, you know, hanging with the women, not having to worry about any pressure or whatever.
Yeah. How about in terms of the women that were there, what do you recall of people's sort of presentation? Like, were people really committed to sort of, like, butch and femme roles? Was it more, like, mixed and ambiguous? What do you remember from that?
So that was also the height of kind of the preppy days.
The preppy days.
Right? So a lot of the women were preppy. You know, their button-down collars and their, you know, starch button-down collars and their jeans and, you know, their poofy hair. And so it wasn't... There wasn't really a butch femme kind of vibe going on. I mean, certainly some women were more masculine than others or whatever, but it was more kind of preppy.
And what about the hookup culture there? Like, was it typical for people to, like, go there to find somebody for the night, or was it more sort of laid back kind of bar, or is it both depending on what you wanted? What do you remember of that?
There wasn't, you know, I don't know how things are obviously today, but there wasn't really hookup culture back then. I mean, it was, you know, if you were looking for somebody, you were looking for a girlfriend. You weren't looking for a one night stand.
Yeah. Tell me more about that.
It just wasn't, I don't know if it has to do with, you know, supposed women's sexual liberation or whatever, which I think has really swung way too far in the opposite direction. It's like, okay, women at this point, like, God love Cardi B, but WAP is just buying into objectification and sexualizing and distilling down to just sex, women, which I think, again, the pendulum swung way too far on that. I'm all about having sexual identity and freedom and expression and all that stuff, but at a certain point, I think you cross that line back over into objectification. So back then, I think, especially in a southernish city town, you know, the values were that you would eventually, you're monogamous, you know, that's what everybody was aiming for, was somebody that they would settle down with and fall in love with. And you didn't cheat, you know, you didn't have two or three girlfriends at a time. Who the hell can manage that, for one thing? I mean, you know, I have a hard enough time with one, you know, much less two. Shit. So there's a pretty much exclusive. If two people were seeing each other, you know, they're seeing each other. That's what you say. Oh, hey, what about her? Well, she's seeing so-and-so. Oh, okay.
And was it sort of like the general audience that would go there? Were most of them in committed relationships, or would they kind of like phase in and phase out of, like, you know, a series of monogamous relationships? Did people go if they had a partner? Did they go with their partner?
Yeah, there were a few older couples, and I think that's part of because Gail and I'm blanking on her girlfriend's name. The two women who initially opened the bar, they were a fairly long-term couple and a bit older. Obviously, I was 17, so, you know, they're opening a bar, they're going to be older than me. So they had a network of friends that wanted a place to go to be able to feel comfortable. You know, it wasn't about necessarily hooking up. It was more about where can we go out to have a good time and dance and feel comfortable without, you know, feeling like people are going to stare at us or whatever. And so there were older couples that would go, and there would be people who are long-term, very long-term relationships that would go. The younger set were a little more musical chairs, you know, and it got a little incestuous at times. I mean, people think the L word invented the whatever
the chart.
We did that shit in Laura Jones's kitchen when we were remodeling it when I was probably 28 or 30, and there were a lot of surprises. I mean, we started putting names up on the wall and drawing lines, and I'm like, what? You went with her? You and I went with her? Oh my God, it's like we slept together. We called it the dyke wall of life, was what we called it. I can't remember what they called it in the L word.
I forget what they called it too, but I remember the visual and how intricate it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, you know, there was a fairly large size community, but at the same time, you know, even if 200 or 300 people, that sounds like a big number until you start dating. Then, you know, it was like, there's not that many of us. And that was another interesting thing to me about the climate back then, was you couldn't really burn bridges. I mean, if somebody really shit on you really bad, yeah, you cut them off. But the community, if you did that to after every breakup, pretty soon there'd be nobody to talk to anymore, because it's a smaller community. And so it kind of forced us to find ways to reconcile things and be able to continue to be friends or whatever, at least be in each other's presence without daggers coming out of the eyes or whatever.
A follow-up question I forgot to ask earlier, what kind of alcohol did they serve there? Was it different kinds of
beer? They just had a beer license. I can't remember if it included wine too, but they just had I don't believe they ever had a liquor license. Of course, people would smuggle shit in, but or go out to the parking lot in their car and pour some in their Coke or whatever.
And how about the bartender? Was it always the same person? Did it sort of rotate who was doing it?
No, I'm not sure, you know, if it was correlated at all with the actual ownership, but there are three people that I remember ever tending bar. Louise, and then Peggy, and then another woman, Susan. Actually, I could put you in touch with her too, because I'm still in touch with her. Susan, I think, was more like a substitute. I don't remember her being there like as a full-timer like Louise or Peggy were. But the funny thing with her, one night I walked in and she asked me for my ID. I think I had turned 21 at this point. And we didn't know each other. So I showed her my ID, and she looks at it, and she says, "That really your last name?" I was like, "Yes, that's my driver's license." And she said, "Smoke." And I said, "Yeah, I know it's kind of unusual. It's German derivation." And she's like, "Is your father's name Marvin?" And I flushed. I was like, "Yeah." And she handed my ID back. She said, "I've worked very closely with him for the past 30 years or whatever it was. I can't even remember, 20 years, something like that." And that was really interesting because that was I don't think I was 21 yet. Because she wound up talking my dad off the ledge about me being gay. And he actually told me that years later, how, what a critical position that, because he knew she was gay. And she was like, "Marvin, how long have you known me?" You know, and it was interesting to get the insight from her at one point that he basically wanted the best for me. He didn't want me to have to live, you know, under the scrutiny or whatever prejudice of being gay. And so he was motivated from when he sent me to a shrink when I was 17 from a very legitimate place. But so, yeah, that was pretty cool that the actual bartender there that night actually worked with my dad.
You mentioned a shrink?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
So sometime during my senior year, Dad found some more evidence of gayness and decided to send me to a psychiatrist to talk about it. It was wintertime, there was snow, it was a Saturday appointment. I drove myself. It was off Nicholasville Road, and there was like one set of tire tracks going in the snow. So I knew it was just me and her. And her office was like inside a foyer, inside another hallway. And we had to unlock all these doors to even get in there. And she, you know, I sat down and I thought I was going to bop in there and just say, you know, "I'm gay, my dad doesn't like it." And we were going to have a conversation and I was going to go home. Well, for some reason, I just got really emotional and I couldn't. It was very hard for me to actually say it out loud. I guess because I was scared what was going to happen next if I actually said it out loud. And so, you know, she said, "Why don't you tell me why you're here?" And I said, "Well, my dad and I are fighting a lot." And she said, "Any idea why?" And I said, "Yeah." And then she was like, "And?" And then I just kind of started crying and getting all flushed and everything. And so she, such body language, she leans forward and she hands me a tissue and she says, "Take your time," you know, and she's leaning forward and being all maternal like. And so finally I managed to say, "I'm gay and my dad doesn't like it." And she leaned back, crossed her arms and her legs and said, "Oh, I see." And I checked out in that very moment. I mean, this was kind of along the time of the infancy of body language. I had heard enough about it to know what I had just seen was somebody completely shutting me out. And so I checked out myself and I just sat there and endured the rest of the hour. And then I got home and my dad said, "How'd it go?" I said, "Terrible, and I'm not going back." And he didn't send me back. So, but another kind of funny story from that time, I came home from somewhere and I kept a little bit of a journal kind of thing, and I would write stupid 17-year-old stuff like who I kissed or who I thought was cute or whatever. And my dad had found it was hidden under my bed, and apparently he was trying to catch the cat, and the cat ran under my bed, and he found this book. He explained all this to me as, you know, "I'm not invading your privacy, but here's how I found this." And so he says to me, "I want you to cut out the gay sex." I'm 17, right? "I want you to cut out the gay sex." I said, "Dad, if sex was all there was to it, I'd do just as good as sit at home and masturbate." And he goes, "And that's exactly what I suggest you do." And then we both went around opposite corners away from each other. And I'm sure, I mean, I was laughing my ass off, and I'm sure he was laughing because it was just so bizarre, a conversation between a father and a 17-year-old girl.
How did your all's relationship sort of develop over the years since, like, you know, you obviously eventually you get back to Lexington, you're going to the country. Does he ever, like, find out more about your life, your dad, I mean, or is it you don't really talk about that? Like, what kind of happened?
Yeah, so the first real serious girlfriend I had as an adult, we were together for like 3.5 years, and I brought her home at one point, because I was living in Bowling Green at the time, and so we'd come up for a weekend, and I think we'd stayed in a hotel or something, or with friends, and so we'd gone to my dad's and my stepmother's house, and he met her and spent some time with her, and so afterwards, I had asked him, what'd you think? You know, because he was meeting one of my girlfriends for the first time in the context of, this is my girlfriend, you know, and he said, well, she was okay, and I immediately got mad. I'm like, what are you talking about? And then he said, I think you can do better. And I was like, and you know what? How did I react to that? It's not like he's prejudiced because she's a girl. No, he doesn't like her because he thinks I can do better. So, you know, I had a pretty early understanding that my dad really had my best interests at heart. And again, he instilled a lot of strengths in me and a lot of truths in me and a lot of embracing of my intellect and not dumbing myself down. And, you know, so he passed away about 8 years ago, unfortunately. But, you know, our relationship was definitely complicated. It was very complicated. I mean, he wound up kicking me out of the house midway through the first semester, my first semester of college. And I was literally homeless for about a week. I was literally homeless for about a week. And that was a really, really odd time. But for all our rocky roads, you know, ultimately we wound up having a very honest relationship, a very genuine relationship. And a lot of parents and kids don't ever get there.
How about the rest of your family in terms of, you know, you being a lesbian and whatnot, was there ever sort of like, because I mean, I know you mentioned the maternal grandmother, and then you just explained how your relationship with your dad developed over time. Was there ever an official sort of coming out when it came to the rest of your family, or did it happen sort of in an episode
sort
or
of.
Not happen?
Yeah, so my mom obviously found out, even though she was in England, you know, dad had to tell her that he was moving me to Kentucky and why. So she found out then, she was over there and I was here, so we didn't ever really have like a long conversation about it. And then my sister, she and I had kind of been close. She was still living in Fort Walton Beach, but she came up for my high school graduation. And that night I actually took her out to the country, and, you know, and she was asking me like, you know, how do you do it and all this stuff. I'm like, use your imagination, Kim, come on. But at one point I needed to go to the bathroom, and she was like, I said, you know, I'll be back. And she's like, where are you going? I'm like, I gotta go pee. Don't leave me alone. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? Well, what if somebody asked me to dance or something? I was like, well, if you like the song, dance. If not, politely decline. You know, like, no one's gonna like accost you here. So she was, so my immediate family, I kind of describe as the devil's triangle, because at any given time, one of them was perfectly accepting and open, one of them hated it, and the other was kind of, you know, don't like it, but I'll tolerate it. And they would change positions, like, you know, one day it's my mom that's okay, and then my dad hates it, and then my sister hates it, and my dad's okay. And, you know, so I kind of had to keep up with who was in what position at any given time. I mean, my sister wound up becoming a way over the top holy roller person, and we've basically had zero relationship for the last like probably 15-20 years or so. And that wasn't just because of me being gay, that was just her being judgmental and on a bunch of different fronts.
Okay, gotcha. And how about the extended family beyond like the triangle sort of dynamic that you described? Mm-hmm.
Well, my paternal grandfather died when I was in second grade. So he never, you know, we never had an occasion to go there. My grandmother on that side of the family, she had my dad when she was 42. She was actually born in 1897. She graduated college in 1918, which was 2 years before women could vote. So can you imagine being a college graduate not being able to vote? So I had been expecting her to pass away, you know, just as soon as my grandfather did. I was scared to death I was going to lose my mama Kate too. And after about, you know, 20 years of waiting, I finally stopped obsessing with when she was going to die because she just kept going. And she actually made it just shy of 102 before she passed away in 1999. So she almost saw three different centuries, which was pretty cool. But I never told her because I really felt like she came from such a different time that there would be no way to explain it to her and no way for it not to be offensive or whatever. Because this, you know, she would have been in her 80s and 90s by this time. I'm like, what good could come of it? And I idolized her. And so I didn't want to do anything to create any kind of fissure in our relationship. I did take one of my girlfriends there to her house. We slept in separate bedrooms. I told her that, you know, I said, while we're there, we're not sleeping together because I'm not going to put it in her face when, you know, I don't want to tell her because I don't think there's anything that good that could come of it. So she never knew. And then my mom's side of the family was so Pentecostal holiness, white supremacist that I don't really have much relationship with any of them except for my, she's my mom's first cousin. So I don't know what it makes her to me. First cousin once removed or something. She's about my age. She's gay too. She was adopted. So I'm sure, you know, that side of the family's very comfortable knowing that Kelly was actually adopted. So we don't, you know, we don't have to, but she's had a tough time. She has had a very tough time.
And how about during this time period when you're at the country, were you, how do I put this? Like, in terms of work, did you have to do anything for work, or were your finances sort of covered somehow?
Oh, no, I was on my own.
Yeah, that's the sense I was getting.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So yeah, what kind of stuff did you do for money?
This is terrible. There were, like, three typical jobs back around that time. Now, one of them came a little bit later, which is Toyota. It was the dyke jobs, Domino's Pizza, UPS, or Toyota.
Really?
And so I did, yes, those were the three. If you were a lesbian in Lexington, you worked at one of those three places at some point in time.
I'm writing that down.
So I was a Dominoid. I was a Dominoid for a long time. In fact, I wound up managing the store in the Bowling Green for a time before I went back to school. Again, my dad kicked me out of the house in the middle of my first semester at college. And so after that semester, I was gone for like, I think I went back when I was 25, something like that.
Do you have any idea why, you know, Toyota, Domino's, UPS, why those were more of like the, for this group of people, like the lesbian-y jobs or something? Like, why those places?
Back then, there was still an expectation that, you know, you'd wear a skirt and heels to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a big part of it. It was a place where you could wear slacks and tennis shoes, you know, and a button-down shirt or whatever. So the dress code was a big part of that, that, you know, if you worked retail, women pretty much wore dresses back then. If you worked in office, wore a dress. School teacher, that kind of, you had to have a degree for that, for one thing.
And so, you mentioned that you went through, you know, a couple of the triad jobs. Did people ever ask you about your romantic life when you were at work? Was that something you were open about, or was it just, you know, I'm at work, I don't talk about stuff like that?
I can't hide. You know, once I became an adult and figured out, you know, how to fend for myself and how to weigh the risks, you know, when I was working at Domino's, everybody knew I was gay. I mean, there was a certain, again, there were a lot of lesbians who worked for Domino's. Just about every store had at least one, you know. So it was just no big deal. And my one manager I had for the longest time, he would always, you know, flirt with me and say he was going to convert me and all this stuff. And, of course, he wound up many years later getting fired for sexual harassment. And I was like, but Steve was my buddy. I mean, we were just kidding around. He'd rub my shoulders. I enjoyed it. You know, he knew he was never getting lucky. But he did wind up overstepping the bounds, and he wound up getting fired for sexual harassment. But, yeah, so I'm not sure if that answered your
question. It did answer the question.
Okay.
You answered it. Okay, a couple other follow-up questions I thought of as we've been talking. Some of the other interviewees have mentioned at the time of like the late 70s, early 80s, the women's lib movement, some of them being involved in it, some of them not being involved in it, and just having just, you know, heard things about it. What is your recollection of that, you know, during the time period of the country and just that general?
Yeah, because of my age and I had that mentality of I hate politics, I don't understand it, I didn't really get involved in that sort of thing. I did through, I love music, and I know a bunch of local musicians, and in my early 20s was when I was starting to really get into the music scene in Lexington. And so some of those people did, like, I was outside the federal courthouse rallying for Roe versus Wade. There was a protest out at the federal correctional facility on Leestown Road. I don't know if you know, there's a maxi unit, they called it. It's a maximum security unit out there. Yeah, I'm sure I have an FBI file by this time, but those were the only couple of things that I did specifically around activism that early in my life. I mean, certainly since then, I mean, you can't count the number of marches or rallies I've been to, so.
Yeah, but those were the ones that you did sort of at that time, or around.
Yes.
Kind of period. Yes. Can you tell me more about, at the time, like, again, when you were that age, your investment in those topics? Like, what was it that made you feel, you know, that, especially at that age, to get that passion about, like, you know, politics or whatever? What was it that kind of reached out at
you? You know, honestly, I think it was that the people who invited me or told me about these events were people that I looked up to and admired and wanted to get to know better and wanted them to like me. You know, because, I mean, other than holding a sign or chanting a chant, it wasn't like I was in any leadership position. I certainly wasn't in any position to be a big donor or anything like that. So it was just being a warm body there and kind of trying to show people that I admired that I cared about these kind of topics. And I was wanting to learn more about that kind of stuff, but I was so young.
Yeah. Were those people, did they also go to the country, or were they not part of that same group?
Yeah.
Oh, they were.
Oh, yeah.
Were there other people at the country who got into the more, like, activist-y kind of stuff from what you remember? Do you remember anything about that?
Not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was mostly, you know, 20-somethings that, you know, either were on the prowl or, you know, had a girlfriend that they were, you know, beating other women off of. Uh-huh. There was a lot of clickiness there. Yeah, there was some clickiness, depending on, like, what side of town you lived on or what high school you went to, what softball team you were on, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I definitely have some follow-up questions about that. Tell me more about the clicks stuff. You know, was it... Did it kind of organize social life there? Was it, you know, maybe not particularly prominent?
You know, I might have been a little hypersensitive to that, because, again, I moved back here when I was 17, and, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to make a lot of friends. And so it may be some of my perception that's feeding that. But there definitely were some snooty people.
Uh-huh. In terms of the clientele there was a couple questions I didn't ask. You mentioned that it was a lot of 20-somethings. Was that the typical age group that was there overall? Maybe there's some older people and obviously some younger people too. But overall, like 20s is what you said?
Yeah, 20s maybe into young 30s, but not much. You know, if there was somebody there that was 40, that was like, oh, an old lady in here.
Okay. Yeah. And what about like the racial demographics? Was it mostly white? Was it mixed? What kind of place was it in that sense?
I didn't personally know a lot of Black lesbians. Of course, Hispanic or Asian just wasn't even a question at that time. There were certainly, you know, some that we played softball with or basketball with or whatever. Nobody was ever excluded. I mean, nobody, I never felt, I guess because the whole athletic part of it, you know, if you don't embrace Black people and you're trying to be an athlete, you're just stupid, you know? So I think that part of our existence kind of, you know, being on teams and being athletes for the most part, I never felt like a Black person wasn't welcome. You know, there's a few names that are coming to mind right now where I'm like, nobody ever said don't hang out with her, or oh my God, don't invite her, or why are you dancing with her, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So there were people and they would like come there. It was just that demographics in terms of like the majority of people who were in the bar.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know what the barriers may have been, because certainly, I mean, if I knew like 3 Black girls in my entire high school that were gay, surely there were more than that. But they were hiding for some reason. I don't know if it's their own cultural reasons that they were so hidden. I mean, I dated a Black girl when I was a senior in high school, and then one of the hottest women that ever hung out at the country, oh my God, she was gorgeous. And she was Black, you know, and everybody's like, oh my God, she's gorgeous, you know, but she had a girlfriend you're going to actually talk to, one of the people that I referred you to, but yeah, I just never picked up on any racism like that.
Mm-hmm. And how about, class in terms of like, were a lot of the people who came to the bar, like more working class? Were they, not in that socioeconomic class? Like what kind of like jobs did people have?
Mostly blue collar, fast food, you know, because it was that demographic. I mean, it would be rare if you know, had somebody who was like an accountant or something. You know, that was rare, a white collar professional.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about the blue collar sort of white collar thing. So it would sort of stand out if someone was, I don't know, mentioned that they were from a more white collar kind of working background.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, just like the size of the country, that it was a pretty small place, that even like 20 people in there would feel a little crowded.
In that one room. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned that sometimes there'd be even more people in that. Do you have any recollection of like, what was like the most people you ever saw there? If you can kind of like ballpark guesstimate.
A packed Saturday night would probably be, I say like 80 people.
Wow. And do you remember like what were the
60 to 80 people would be cram packed.
Yeah, 60 to 80.
And I'm trying to remember if I know at the bar that occasionally we'd be told the fire marshal said there was too many people in there. That was another thing they do, is the fire marshal would come by. I think that happened a few times at the country too, where they were like, we can't let anybody else in because fire marshal.
Oh, tell me more about do you remember anything else about the fire marshal thing? Like, they were just worried that if it got too many people how would the fire marshal, like, know about the number of people that were there? Like, how did it work?
I don't know if, you know, I could speculate on that. I don't know if maybe there was some, you know, one person that just put it in their mind, I'm going to drive by there every Saturday night. Once I see so many cars, we're going to go in there and bust the place. I don't know if it was something like that. I don't know if you've ever heard of Cafe Element OP.
Heard of, but I don't know much about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how it got shut down, ultimately. The last night that bar was open, we got thrown out early by the fire marshal for too many people. It's like, you can't let us have the swan song. It's the last night of this place being open, and you're going to – and so we wound up in the middle of Main Street singing a particular song that was relevant – with all these fire trucks around, the fire marshal and police telling us to go home.
What was the name of the place again? Cafe what?
LMNOP.
Oh, okay.
Which Bradley would explain stands for Lick My Nasty Old Pussy.
Oh, I did not realize that, but duly noted.
I actually heard him say that from the stage more than one time. I'm not sure if that actually was the original intention, but those words came out of Bradley's mouth on many occasions.
Okay, gotcha. Do you remember what were the more popular nights of the country? Was like Saturday night the biggest night? Was it Friday or was it pretty even?
Thursday and Saturday. For some reason, Thursday night's always been a big night to go out in Lexington.
It is, and I don't know why, but it is.
It's like almost the weekend, we can't wait, so we're going out tonight. So Thursday night was a big night. Saturday night was a big night. I think they only had cover on Friday and Saturday, and so you know, a lot of us were on budgets. It's like, I'm going to go out Thursday night when it's free and Saturday night pay my cover. You know, I'm not going Friday because I don't want to pay cover twice.
Mm-hmm. And what was the cover typically?
I think I remember it being like $3.
Okay, yeah. And was there a membership card? Some other people have mentioned membership cards. Was that part of your experience?
I believe that was for a brief time. And, that used to be like a mechanism to get around any old redneck just walking into place. I've seen that at work a lot in the South, a couple of places in South Carolina that I actually have membership cards for. I can't remember if it was you or Wiley that I was telling about a place in Columbia, South Carolina called The Fortress.
You told me about that.
Where the lady actually, you know, walked across the parking lot and asked what I was doing. But yes, I think those sort of things were intended, again, if a carload of rednecks showed up and they were wanting to come in, need to see your, this is a private club, I need to see your membership.
Yeah. And did anyone ever who wasn't supposed to be there, did anyone who wasn't supposed to be there ever, like, walk into the bar, or did that not really ever happen?
Not that I remember, and I think that foyer, the lack of signage and the foyer, because it was like walking into an unknown, right? It wasn't like you walked directly into the bar. You had to park in the parking lot and then figure out which place the bar actually was. You know, because unless you saw somebody walking in and out, you didn't even know which door the bar was. And then even if you figured out it was that bar, that door in the back left corner, that still meant you had to go inside a foyer in the light, because that foyer was always lit up, and then navigate back to that door that you didn't know what was behind that door.
Yeah, that would be really unlikely that somebody would do that. Just now,
yeah,
that
I mean, maybe some of the other people you talk to, it wasn't the kind of place that you would accidentally wander into.
Yeah.
You know, I don't recall ever having somebody show up and go, you know, oh, what's this place? We were passing by and we thought we'd come in for a drink, you know, because there was no reason for that to ever happen. And I don't know if you know, if part of your research is like, how did people find the place? I don't know if you're familiar with, have you ever heard of the Lesbian Connection?
I used to get it in the mail, the newsletter, and it's like a little booklet. So yeah, it's still around.
Yeah, so, people would ask, they put in the personals or whatever, we're coming to Lexington next month, where can we go? You know, or there was even like little directories of women's bars or women-friendly businesses in different states and stuff. Oh. I'm not sure that the country or the Hidden Door was ever explicitly like took out an ad or anything, but I know that a lot of that networking took place through the Lesbian Connection. Yeah, I'm about to move to Atlanta. Where are the places? Where are the bars?
Yeah.
And another mechanism, I think I may have told you this, the first time we talked was taxi companies.
Yeah.
You know, you call the taxi company and say, where are the gay bars? They know. They can probably tell you where the whorehouses are and the crack houses.
And the lesbian bars. Okay, wow, the Lesbian Connection thing is really interesting to me. And a lot of those things are archived. It would be great if I could find you know, just someone like writing you a letter of like, oh, I'm moving to the area, you know, what is here? Because they always have an opening section with all the sort of editorial questions. That's neat. Okay, I have some more questions about the country. There was a name change and an ownership change eventually. They changed to the Hidden Door. Can you tell me what you remember about that? Like why that happened, when that happened? Did anything change?
I don't really remember, but Louise Atwood and I talked recently, and she's got all that off the top of her head, so she can completely fill you in on that.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. And then you mentioned softball a couple times. Was this related to the Valkyries or some other softball team in the area?
I don't remember Valkyries.
Uh-huh. There was a previous interviewee that mentioned to me that there was like a lesbian softball team that would play in Woodland Park, and they were called the Valkyries. And it was somewhere in that time period, but I figured you mentioned softball and sports a few times, so I was curious, like, if other people in the country, like, played that sport, who'd they play it with, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so City League Ball, Fraley's, well, firstly, it was Barnett Pavers, the Pavers. And then it turned into Fraley's Wildcats. They were like the Super League team in town. They traveled and they had matching bat bags and all this crap, but they were supposed to be amateur softball players. There were like, at the height, I think there was a double A, A, B, and C league. There was like four different leagues, which were levels of play. And I typically played B league, which generally was in Idlehour or Castlewood. Those were kind of the two biggest places where everybody played. Shillitoe was for tournaments. I don't think there were regular leagues out at Shillitoe, but Castlewood and Idlehour were the two big parks where slow pitch women's softball was played.
Mm-hmm. And was it mostly lesbians that were sort of on these teams, or was it more mixed?
It was mixed. It was definitely mixed. Like, there was one team we played against that had mother-daughter players on it. There's certainly a lot of straight players. Most of the teams that had a good number of lesbians, though, were almost exclusively lesbians.
And when it comes to the country, did you usually go there alone or with friends or with a girlfriend, say?
Yes.
All of it?
Yeah, just a penny, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for part of the time, I worked at, there was a Domino's that was right across Lane Allen from the country. And so, you know, if we were dead and I got cut loose at 10 o'clock, I'd often just go across the street just to hang out and have a beer on some random Tuesday night or whatever. But again, like Thursday, Saturday were typically the biggest days, and generally it'd be a group of us that would meet up there. You know, it didn't necessarily carpool or, you know, drive around picking each other up or whatever, but we always knew who all was going to be out that night, kind of thing.
And how long did you go to the country for in general? Like, were you there up until they ended up officially closing, or did you stop going before that point?
So when I was, I think 21 was when I, and that would have been 82, was when I moved to Bowling Green to manage Domino's. Actually, I met a girl through the management program at Domino's that managed the Owensboro store. And she and I started dating. So I moved down there, was working for her. Well, then they quickly promoted me to manager in Bowling Green. So I was away for like a year and a half or so. And I think it was after that that the country actually closed down, or Hidden Door actually closed down. But I don't remember exactly when they closed down. I don't recall being there the last night. Maybe I was, I don't know. But, you know, LMNOP was such a dramatic closing night because of the police, the fire marshal and the police and all that crap throwing us out in the street. So I don't know if I was there and I just don't remember it because it was, you know, oh, well, it's the last night. Gonna miss it. You know?
Mm-hmm. And do you,
has anybody told you when it closed?
It's kind of vague. I'm still trying to get a sense through these interviews of like when and why did this place close? And it seems like
about 40 years ago. Shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like, you know, some people have different answers. You know, someone was telling, the other day was telling me about how there was sort of a, what they referred to as a cowboy bar that opened sort of across the street, and that increased some of the sort of outside drive-by harassment or name-calling. They mentioned that, you know, less people were going there because a lot of people were getting partnered up and kind of like not maybe going out as often. But it's still not really clear. So I'm definitely hoping through these interviews to get like a clearer picture of, okay, so like, why did this place go away? Cause it seemed like it had a committed client base that found it to be this very beloved location. So it is kind of,
yeah. Louise might be able to help you out with that. She's got a mind like a steel trap.
All right. So I'll definitely.
And she was so directly involved in it. I'm not sure if she was directly involved all the way up till the end, but I know that she's enough of a, you know, want to know everything about everything kind of person, what's going on, that she probably will be able to tell you just about the exact date.
Gotcha. While it was open, while the country was, or Hidden Door Country was open, was it a big part of your social life? Was it one of the, like, sort of primary?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And would you say a lot of your sort of social networks, like your friends, were at least went to the country or were a part of it in some way?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And moving sort of away from the country at this point, during that time period, were there any other women's bars or spaces that you went to? It sounds like to me the country was kind of like the only women's bar. Did you go to any?
That was it. And I mean, we could certainly go down to the bar, but I never really felt welcome during that time, like in the early 80s. I never felt welcome in the bar. Mm-hmm. I think that changed over time. But, you know, there were plenty of times that I felt like I was being, me and my friends, my female friends were being looked at like, what the hell are y'all doing here? Fish, you know, these lesbians. Of course, if you were tipping the queens, that was okay.
So you went there, but it was, you got a bit of a vibe, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, I preferred Bradley's place because it was so non-judgmental. I mean, you could be punk, you could be gay, you could be straight, black, white, female, male, impersonator, whatever. And it just, that was a much more welcoming space. It was a much more weird space for damn sure, but...
What was it called? Bradley's Place?
Oh, the Cafe L-M-N-O-P.
Oh,
Bradley,
right.
Bradley Bicklesheimer. Yeah.
Can you tell me, where was that located? Just tell me more about it.
It was on East Main Street. They've torn down. It was kind of toward downtown from Thoroughbred Park on that side of the street, just like within a block or so. So just a couple blocks from the bar.
Mm-hmm. And what was it?
You should, if you're interested in more of that, you should contact WLEX because Sue Wiley, who was a big news personality for many, many years on LEX and on radio, she did a series that they only aired at 11:30 at night after the news because it was too much for prime time about LMNOP, and it was called Lexington's Bar Bazaar. And I would love if somebody could dig up. I mean, I've never called LAX myself. I'm sure they have.
I'm sure it's there on file, though. Yeah.
But it was really funny because after they did that show, all these straight people, you know, suburbanite, like married couples, started showing up at LMNOP just to be able to say they'd gone. And it was so funny because nobody would make them feel uncomfortable because it was such an opening place, but you could just tell they were just like scared to death. They half the time they wouldn't even finish their drinks before they left because they just were so out of place.
Did you go there?
And only their own selves that were making them feel that way.
Right. Did you go there pretty often?
Not that often because there were other options at the time that LMNOP was on the table for me. There was like the Metro, I think, was open, and one, Club 141 on Vine Street was open, Bungalow, or I'm trying to think, Joe's was a Bungalow, then it moved and it was Joe's. If you want to know about any of these places, we can schedule more hours of time of your life if you're willing to listen to me. But
definitely, no, for sure. And actually, I was thinking that we could, because I definitely have some more questions, but at this point, we're like at an hour 40, and I don't know if you have to go back to work or, you know, what's going on with that. So how about we schedule a part two, and it'll be much shorter than this, and it'll be, I'm going to ask you about those other bars and just about what they were like, and then I have some closing questions about the country of just like, oh, what do you think looking back on it now, that kind of stuff, and then that's the end of it. So we'll do like a mini part two. How about that?
Okay.
Thank you for giving me your time too.
Think about if you want to learn more about the non-bar scene, like I can't remember if it was you or Wiley that I was talking to about the coffee houses and dances and the concerts that we would produce, women's music, that kind of thing was also pretty prominent in Lexington, a big part of our history.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, I'm writing that down too. All right, so I'll reach out like over email about a part two. Does that sound good?